All right, welcome to the Court of Appeals. The case that is before us is in the matter of the Leora L. Berkley Irrevocable Insurance Trust, dated September 17, 1993. The file number is A20-0908. Counsel, you will each have 15 minutes of oral argument for the appellant. And the cross respondent. And it's my understanding that the respondent cross appellant objectors and attorney for the respondent trustee will be splitting their time. Is that correct?
Yes, Your Honor.
All right. And it's 7.5 minutes for each of you?
Yes, Your Honor.
All right. Yes, very good. And if I just could have the judges acknowledge their presence. I'm Judge Hooten. I will be the presiding judge. We also have Judge Matthew Johnson and Judge Randy Sleater. Are both of you on?
Yes, Judge. This is Judge Johnson. I can see and hear everybody.
All right, Judge Sleater.
Yes, Judge Sleater, and I can see and hear everyone as well. Thank you.
All right, very good. Then, with that being said, then the appellant may proceed at this time, and please introduce yourself and your client as you commence your oral argument.
Good morning, Your Honors. John Ruddell on behalf of Paul Gray. We are here, obviously, to address the District Court's April 22nd, 2020 order related to the Leora Berkley Irrevocable Insurance Trust. Specifically, there are two significant and related deficiencies in that order that we believe need to be reviewed and will result in the bulk of the order being reversed and remanded. The first of those is the lack of notice related to the expansive scope of issues addressed by the district court at the hearing in January of 2020. It's important to note that the initial petition was served. I believe it was published and a hearing was scheduled. That hearing never happened. Prior to that hearing happening, the objectors filed an objection and the hearing was struck from the court's calendar, reassigned to a different judge. And then the parties engaged in mediation and a motion hearing was scheduled by Mr. Gray to resolve a specific issue that would allow the parties to either potentially resolve the issues themselves and or streamline a potential hearing on the petition.
But the petition was much broader than what you claim was, than the issue presented to the judge.
The petition absolutely was broader. That is correct, Your Honor.
All right. And why did you limit it to the vesting issue?
Because there are a number of beneficiaries. There's a chart in the back of the initial petition that shows kind of like the family tree. The vesting date was the root cause of the dispute between the parties as to when did these people take their interests and therefore how did they properly flow after that. Because of that, answering that question in the same way that you would answer a preliminary question in any other proceeding would allow us to either, like I said, resolve the issue potentially between the parties, but also when we got to an evidentiary hearing, understand what evidence would have been needed to address those issues and how to properly frame and articulate the issues to the court. Because initially there was a question as to whether or not the shares vested at the date of death of Ms. Berkel or at some future date. And that was the root cause. Because of that, the analysis as to when you determined who took what was demonstrably different, and what witnesses you would need, what evidence you would need were significantly different. And so we brought this one issue to the court to say, look, this is a purely legal question. What does the document say? As we've noted, both in our brief, as well as in the underlying memoranda, you look to the document. What does it say? And in this document, it specifically says upon her death. And therefore, that is the only thing that the parties were planning to address at the hearing. If you look at the transcript, I believe it's 9 pages. It was a very short hearing. No evidence was provided. No testimony was taken. The trustee didn't even participate. They sat in the back of the courtroom because the only issue was that vesting date issue. And then the court decided to issue an order that went significantly beyond that scope and resolved a number of issues, which, as we noted in our reply, required the court to make a number of assumptions, which it noted I believe there were four or five of them that it specifically noted in its order saying no one argued this, no one presented evidence on that. That was because that wasn't properly before the court.
Now, is your client contesting or appealing the judge's decision regarding the vesting issue?
No. The vesting issue was determined to be the date we proposed it to be, and no one has challenged that date.
And specifically, how does that determination affect what happens in this case then? If no one's challenging that, how does it affect this case? Assuming the judge had just limited the analysis to the vesting issue, how would that determine what the result would be in your case?
So when you look at the language at issue, which gets somewhat to the second issue here, the specific language revolves around right of representation, by right of representation or with right of representation, but functionally right of representation is the language that matters. That language, as used in tens of thousands of documents throughout Minnesota and the country, is words of substitution. They are there to prevent the lapsing of a future gift based on the death of the named recipient. In order to do that, you need to know what the date is that the person has to be alive. Did they have to be alive on the date of death of the donor, or did they have to be alive at some future date? And that matters because many of these people have died, and they died at different dates. So because the vesting date was the date of death of the donor, that language is applied at that date, which in our case only applies to Carl Drill, who predeceased the donor. Therefore, all of the other named donees survived, and that language ceased to function in its intended words of substitution because they survived. They took their gift. And so knowing that date was important because had, for example, that date not happened yet, there are a number of people that have died in the intervening period after the donor's death that may or may not have altered the analysis.
I think you said the vesting date is not disputed on appeal. Is that correct? Was it in dispute at the time of the district court proceedings?
Yes, that was actually the point of the hearing, is that that was disputed. There was an argument by the objectors that it was some date in the future and that therefore they had not vested yet.
So if the district court had limited its ruling to that issue, then and then scheduled another hearing, presumably, what would you have done?
We would have done a number of things. One, we would have briefed how the flow chart worked. Where did the shares go based on who took the initial allocation under the trust? And specifically with relation to our client, Mr. Gray, Brenda Drill would have taken in the step of Mr. Carl Drill based on his predeceasing and her being his issue at the donor's death.
Okay, so could I back up? My more specific question is, what evidence would you have introduced at the second hearing?
That was what I was getting to, Your Honor. So Carl Drill's share is very clear legally because the facts aren't there. Although honestly, that fact would need to have been proven up, his date of death, all those things. It becomes an issue with Lorna Drill, Brenda's mother. Brenda's mother died by all evidence intestate, and Brenda was her sole heir and issue in this case. And therefore evidence would have needed to be produced to show that Lorna's share descended through the intestacy statute to her daughter, Brenda, as opposed to by some will that would need to be introduced or some other mechanism. And so that evidence was not presented. The court made a footnote, I believe, that presumably Brenda took by right of representation. That's incorrect. Brenda took by the devise under the intestacy statute from her mother, Lorna, and she took under Carl directly as a gift from the donor in substitution. So that specifically would be evidence, but there also are a number of other beneficiaries, and some of them have died in intervening periods and shares have been paid to people. That issue, it would have potentially grown beyond Mr. Gray.
And just to be specific, so the form of the evidence would be what? Documents from Lorna's probate case?
There was no probate, so there would need to be whatever evidence could be determined to show that she did not have a probate, that she did not leave a will, whether that be done by affidavit or what. We would have had to dig into that.
Was Brenda Drill's will made part of the record?
No, because again, that would have been brought in later to show that Mr. Gray took her interest, because the only issue that was presented was that vesting date issue. Therefore, determination of Mr. Gray or any other beneficiary's interest wasn't presented. But yes, her will and the record of the, I believe it's a Sibley County Court, would have likely come into the record to establish that Mr. Gray was in fact the recipient of the devise under her will.
Was that fact that he was the devisee under the will, was that made part of the record for the district court judge's opinion in this case?
The district court took judicial notice of the court file from Sibley County and reviewed it. It was not presented by any party.
A minute ago, you said that it was inaccurate to say that Brenda took by right of representation from Lorna. I mean, to me, that seems perhaps not necessarily incorrect, but it just simply begs a question about what was the basis of her representation. In other words, whether it was because she was her mother's issue or her mother's heir. And so on. I mean, am I correct or incorrect in that observation?
That it's incorrect, Your Honor. She would be her successor in interest, if we want to use sort of a more generic term. But by representation, it specifically means this person is no longer here on the date of decision. Who steps in their place? And representation specifically is limited to lineal issue of the deceased individual. So that person must have predeceased the gift giver, in this case, the donor of the trust, and then they must leave surviving issue, and the issue would be calculated based on the date of death of the recipient of the gift, but then they would be around at the time the donor died. But well, when you say right of...
Go ahead and complete your thought. I'm sorry.
It's just that right of representation is a highly technical term. It has specific meaning in documents, and so we just need to make sure that we use it precisely.
Well, I was going to ask you, but you make a statement on page 14 of your brief, the language, quote, with right of representation refers to issue, not heirs. And I guess that's the same issue. And I'm wondering, I mean, there are cases, I think Higgins is one, where the language used in the instruments, both the will and the trust agreement, says basically to so-and-so and to his heirs by right of representation. It seems like that the term right of representation is used in conjunction with heirs. I think there's other cases in Minnesota where the relevant documents might say, and to his issue with right of representation. So in other words, I was led to believe that it depends. I mean, representation could be based on this fact or that fact, but you seem to be saying that by definition, it's limited to issue.
Under the probate statute, there's a definition of representation, and it specifically refers to lineal descendants as opposed to heirs generally, which would include non-lineal descendants like aunts and uncles, brothers and sisters, parents, things like that. And so in the absence of any sort of qualification where it says to so-and-so's heirs or something like that, in this case where it's just the bald language, right of representation, it would go to lineal issue. And I don't believe that the issue of whether it is issue versus heirs is actually disputed by any party in this particular case. But it does come up, as we noted, with Carl's interest, if it had been, for example, life estate or something like that.
Is that statute cited in your brief?
I believe it is. It's in the initial memo. It's a 524.2-102. Thanks. So
I'm looking at your table of authorities.
It would have been, because it wasn't an issue on the appeal, I don't think I cited it in the brief, but it is in the initial memo.
You do cite it on page 14.
Okay.
Near the statement I was mentioning, so I appreciate that. But that applies only to what I might call the first and second generation. Another, or it only with respect to the original beneficiaries, the original donees, if they are, I mean, your position, I think, is that if they are deceased, then their issue would take on their behalf, any issue who are living at the time of Leora's death. Is that correct?
That is correct, yes.
Is that your view, is what I mean to ask? Yeah.
But that
means of determining the next person does not apply at the subsequent generation or subsequent steps.
Right. It's a singular substitution because it's a singular date. So on Leora's death, you had to survey who was alive. Carl had deceased. Brenda was his issue. Brenda stepped into his shoes. Analysis is complete and you don't continue on. A subsequent where you're continuing to roll it to the issue of the specific beneficiaries where it never vests in anyone is essentially what the court created, and it's a fee tail. It would stay in the lineal issue and it would never fully vest in anyone such that it would be theirs.
Referring to your chart, I noticed that there are five children of Marion and Roger Nastandi, and also three children of Harlan Berger. Is there any evidence in the record as to how they took their interest?
No, there isn't. And just to be clear, that chart was prepared by the trustee, but we do all look at it. Our position would be that had we gotten to that evidentiary hearing, one of the issues would have been, for example, Harlan Berger, he has died after Leora, but Lois Berger is still alive according to the chart. I don't know if she's died in the intervening period. Under our interpretation of this, those three children, Bradley, Julie, and Lisa, would not be present beneficiaries of the trust. Most likely, Harlan would have left his estate to Lois. Now, we don't know that. That's one of the other pieces of evidence that we would have gotten into if we were analyzing who the present beneficiaries of the trust are. Did Harlan leave his estate to Lois, as many couples do? Did he leave it to his children? Because it would not have automatically flowed to his issue.
So, but does the arrow on the chart suggest that the trustee has in fact been paying income to Bradley, Julie, and Lisa?
I believe that is what the arrow indicates, yes.
Okay.
And it's that issue where the fact that multiple people have been paid that would have had to be unpacked in the future as to who was entitled to this money. Should it have gone to someone else? And that's why we specifically wanted that vesting date issue cited so that we could determine, because if this opens up seven or eight beneficiaries' interests, the parties may or may not just reach a settlement. But the issue is it would greatly expand what is at issue there. And the vesting date was the critical linchpin to understand all of that.
Is there any procedural law, either a rule of procedure or case law, about how district court, sitting as a probate court essentially, should resolve these issues? In other words, you know, is there any law that suggests the district court should do it one step at a time or one issue at a time, that it should have stopped with the issue that you had noticed rather than going on? Because I guess, you know, there's a general principle that district courts are responsible for managing and administrating their caseload in the way that they see fit, and the appellate courts frequently don't interfere with that. And so if the district judge here thought it was prudent and efficient to resolve all these issues at once, I mean, that seems to be a principle we often rely upon. So I guess what legal authority contradicts that in this context?
Specifically, the cases that we noted regarding notice and the fundamental issue of just basic due process, you have yes, it's possible that the court could, in this proceeding, deal with it at a singular evidentiary hearing. They could schedule the matter, issue the notice, publish it. And at that hearing, everyone essentially has to show up and present what they want to do. Most often, that's not the end of it. There is another hearing set on so that we can adjudicate the issues, and it essentially becomes standard civil litigation at that point. It is subject to the normal civil rules of procedure, to the extent they're not deviated by any probate rules. And that's what normally happens. But yes, the court could, at that hearing that notice was given for, adjudicate the issues. But that didn't happen in this case. That hearing never happened. It was stricken. And the only hearing that ever happened was a hearing that was noticed solely by Mr. Gray for that one issue. And that, at the end of the day, really is a critical flaw. So while the court could have done it one way, it didn't do it in this case.
I noticed that in the conclusion of your principal brief, you ask that the district court's order be reversed and remanded. What What type of remand instructions would you request specifically?
Well, we would specifically request that the vesting date issue is obviously not reversed. That it's not even on appeal, but to the extent it needs to be, that would be affirmed. But the issues, the rest of the issue would be reversed, ideally with instructions related to that right of representation language to indicate to the district court that that issue as a legal matter does not connote a life estate, but it is language of substitution that is determined as of the determination date, and that after that, it is no longer looked at as a limitation on the estate that's given to the individual recipients. That language would be very helpful to resolve going forward, because otherwise the district court's gonna have to analyze it again, reach a legal conclusion as to what that language means, which is very, very clear. Again, it's in thousands upon thousands of documents. And if we wholesale change it now and turn that language into a life estate, we're gonna throw the whole system up into the air. So that type of instruction would be helpful.
It sounds like you're asking for a remand to the district court for the district court to make another legal determination.
It would be the factual determinations that I was talking about. If this court were to remand and say, this is, you know, you've already resolved the vesting date, this is what this language means, go figure out the other issues raised by the trustee in light of those rules. We would have a hearing on who the beneficiaries are, whether or not any payments were improperly made, whether they had to be paid back, trustees fees, the accountings, whether or not those accountings were given, who got them, all of those things would be determined. Those are factual issues for the district court.
And those factual issues are relevant to the first issue, the issue of Mr. Gray's entitlement to income, not to the accounting issue.
They would be relevant to that, and there would be things relevant to the accounting issue as well, which we are not specifically appealing on, but it is something that would have to be addressed.
Okay. All right. Thank you. And thank you, Judge Hooten, for the addition.
All right. I was going to say, Mr. Reddle, you will have 5 minutes for rebuttal. Mr. Westrick, do you want to proceed at this time?
Thank you, Your Honors. Good morning. May it please the court. My name is John Westrick. I represent the various beneficiaries of the Laura Burkle Trust. I think very important, something Mr. Reddle said was to make a legal conclusion. And that is telling, because what the district court judge did here was made a legal conclusion under the trust as to what interest vested, not only the vesting date. There was argument about that in our memorandum below, and then it was responded to. So of course, our view is this was certainly litigated by consent. Just as an aside, we agree that Mr. Gray's claim derives from Brenda Drill. No one's really questioning that. Our view is a trust document is reviewed de novo, and the determination as to what the trust document says here isn't a factual determination. It's a legal one, and that the vesting date and what was vested are so intertwined that the court couldn't determine one without the other. And our position is Article 4, Section 2.2 answers this question, because there's a reset after all of the original donees die. Then how the money is distributed changes.
Well, could I just get back to procedurally how this was presented? I mean, is there any dispute that the only issue that was presented to the court was the vesting date of the beneficial interest of the donees?
Insofar as you say it, yes, but kind of no. We understood the interest vested would also have to be determined in order to determine the vesting date. And so we argued about that at trial below. We believe it was responded to. But those were the issues. The other issues that came up vis-a-vis the accounting and whatnot were not issues that were supposed to be done. There was an agreement of counsel as to that. And if the court's concerned with the procedural niceties, I understand, and there's no problem with vacating it, and we'll go back to Judge Burke. But what the court shouldn't do, please, is listen to Mr. Reddall and say, I had facts I would have determined and show that would show that Mr. Gray took from Brenda's will, or, and I'll just have you do that now rather than go back to the court. He really can't have it both ways. He can't say there's factual issues that should have been determined by the trial court and then ask this court on appeal to determine them, because this court normally doesn't do that. And so our position here, though, is that the court necessarily made a determination of what interest Mr. Gray did or didn't have, and he needed to do that in order to determine what type of vesting, if any, Mr. Gray did or didn't have, and that resolved the legal issues as opposed to the factual issue. I don't know that there is a factual issue here. And then the secondary issue which comes up, which I need to slide into because I've only got 7.5 minutes, is the notion that all of the parties agreed we would get together and decide what to do once the court decided who had what. The issue of the accounts, this isn't in the record because we never got to the point. There are beneficiaries who claim they never received an accounting from the bank. The court would have had to have looked at whether to grant the trustee fees if it turned out the trustee paid people wrong. There to be the question as to whether or not the objectors would be entitled to their attorney fees once we determined whether there was an error. And generally, a trustee is required by courts to make good any of its mistakes. So when the trial court below decided, oh, everything's fine with the accounts, that was just wrong. And it also shifted the burden of proof, because the burden of proof on proving a trustee's accounts is on the trustee, not on us to present evidence. The trustee needed to present evidence showing that all of these things had been done and that they were correct. And one of our, yes, Your Honor.
Is the appellant correct that there is no dispute as to the judge's decision on the date of vesting?
There is not a dispute as to the date of vesting. That is correct.
All right. And now I think if I understand his answer to Judge Johnson's question regarding the remand, if we remand this, then would all issues then be on the table if we agree with him that this was not, that the parties were not allowed sufficient notice to address all these issues that the district court decided above and beyond the vesting date?
No. What interest was vested necessarily had to be determined as part of the vesting date. And because it is a legal, not a factual determination, appellant can't show any prejudice as a result of the judge interpreting the trust to say that these are income beneficiaries and they were not actual gifts that were gone. It's a legal determination. So there's no prejudice if the court did it, particularly since it was addressed below before the court in the Mr. Reddall's reply memorandum, which would demonstrate it certainly was tried by consent, even if that wasn't the intent. Though I thought that was what you'll see in my memorandum. I thought that was part of the issue that was being done. So that's where we are with that. The accounting issue is different. And that's where we are. I've only got 49 seconds left. Do any members of the court have a question?
I do. Could we address the Higgins case? And how do you distinguish this case from Higgins? Because Higgins made a pretty strong case that right of representation does not indicate that there's a life estate that's given.
I believe, Your Honor, I addressed that below. The Higgins case probably isn't good law. It's been superseded by statute. And so as a result, by the Uniform Probate Code, I believe that's so. We addressed that below, and I frankly didn't see that I didn't see that nearly as big an issue as the court obviously does. Our view is that with limitations here, once they say we're going to leave this to this, that it was a limitation. Also, again, Article 4, Section 2.2 really changes from a Higgins analysis because it's clear that later on down the line, everybody's going to get a reset, that the current beneficiaries, meaning if I had a donee who died and didn't leave issue, then we're going to divide that money up as remainder persons and not as beneficiaries. And so what happens is you become an income beneficiary as a result of right by representation, and then you're converted into a remainder person upon the event, the death of the last living donee, which has not yet happened, and you go on. That was how we addressed Higgins, and I believe the trial court made mention of that, but I don't believe Higgins is still good law. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Any other questions?
Judge Hooten, could I follow up on issue? So Mr. Westrick, you say Higgins is superseded by statute. Can you be more specific about which statute and which part of the statutes?
Certainly, Your Honor. Just
I guess you're saying we would find this analysis in your district court memorandum?
Yes, it may have been in my argument in the thing, but Higgins is a 1940 case, and I believe Higgins has been overruled by the Uniform Probate Code. It is no longer good in that regard.
May I suggest that if you could review your district court memorandum after the argument, and I'll do the same, or we'll do the same, and if it's there, then my question's answered. If the statutes that supersede Higgins are not there, could I suggest that you file a letter with supplemental authority after the argument?
I will certainly do that, Your Honor.
Thank you.
All right, Mr. Beyer.
Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Jesse Beyer of Fredrickson and Byron, and I represent Union Bank and Trust Company, the trustee in this matter. As a neutral fiduciary and as the trustee of the trusted issue here, Union has remained neutral with respect to the appellant's primary appeal. That is that he is a beneficiary of the trust. Union's remained neutral throughout this entire process. So for purposes of this appeal, Union's position is relatively narrow. Union has taken the position that the district court did not abuse its discretion through its decision. The primary issues that the appellant and the objector have come forward with are the notice issue and burden of proof with respect to why the district court's order should be reversed. On the notice issue, Union takes a position that it provided notice to all of the parties under Minnesota Statute 501c.0203.
Was there notice that this issue would be determined as part of this hearing where supposedly the only issue that was presented was the vesting date?
Union acknowledges that the parties had discussions and we came to a consensus that this matter would likely be best addressed with at least two separate hearings. But that in and of itself, and there's nothing in the record that is to the contrary, that suggests that the district court was in any way bound by these conversations that we had. There was no stipulation in the record. The parties never came to an agreement on the record. And although if you look at the judge's order on the motion for reconsideration, the judge notes that while he was aware that there was this agreement among the parties, the judge was not bound by any agreement among the parties. Rather, the court was free to make a decision on the whole petition. And that's ultimately what the judge decided to do here. And so I don't find any case law, I don't find any authority, and nothing has been presented by any of the other parties here that an agreement among the parties to a lawsuit can in any way constrain a district court judge's ability to rule on the entire scope of what was presented in the original petition. And so ultimately, that's the position that Union has taken with respect to this appeal.
But was the issues regarding your client raised during the course of that proceeding involving the vesting date?
You mean at the hearing, at the only hearing we had on this?
Yes.
No, none of those issues were raised. They were addressed in the initial petition that we filed with the court.
Well, is that a problem? I mean, is that a problem? Because the other parties weren't even heard on these issues. Am I correct?
Well, I mean, if you look at the procedural history of this, if you look at the procedural history of this matter, we filed our petition in May, and ultimately the objectors filed their objection, and then we have an 8-month time period where nothing really happened before we had that initial hearing in January. During that time period, the other parties could have sent written discovery requests. They could have filed other motions other than the one that Mr. Gray filed, but none of that occurred. Deposition testimony could have been taken during that time period, but nothing happened. And so Union has taken the position that had objectors wanted to pursue their claim, they would have done so. They would have done written discovery. They would have taken depositions, but they didn't do that. And so for them to now say, well, we're not happy with the district court's decision, we should have the opportunity to be heard on these questions, it's kind of questionable given the fact that they had so much time to prove up some of these facts that they say.
But what about the fact that when it was presented to the judge, it was presented to the judge as, we only want you to decide this one issue. And apparently there was no objection to the judge limiting the decision to that. And there was no request made, am I correct, by the objectors to expand it beyond that. So how, with that scenario, does it get expanded to determine your client's rights?
Your Honor, we're not taking the position that the judge should have, at the time of that January hearing, considered all of the issues. We're taking the position that there is no, just because the parties came to an agreement doesn't mean that the district court judge had to abide by that agreement or was under any obligation to not consider all of the issues that we presented in our original petition.
Okay. And are there issues of fact here that are in dispute with regard to your client's rights?
We don't believe so. We addressed all of the issues that we wanted to be addressed by the district court in our original petition. And all of those issues are issues that could properly be considered by the district court under the trust code.
Isn't the issue of whether there's a breach of fiduciary duty an issue of fact that's in dispute?
Potentially, but again, we had an 8-month period where nothing occurred on that claim. The objectors have an obligation to move their claim forward, and that didn't occur here. The most that we have with respect to the objector's claim for breach of fiduciary duty comes in their objection, where they say there was a breach of fiduciary duty. We're not sure exactly what that breach was, but there's nothing else in the record to address the objector's claim on that front.
Mr. Byers, I'm looking at the district court record. You, I believe, noticed up a hearing for the court scheduled it for July 10. You wrote a letter saying, I'm unavailable then, please reschedule. The district court then noticed a hearing for July 17. Just looking at of 2019, looking at the minutes, it appears like nothing happened. I'm unclear whether you were present or not, but am I correct that nothing happened there? I'm wondering whether you're present. I'm also wondering whether you re-noticed hearing on your petition thereafter.
Your Honor, you are correct that nothing happened at the rescheduled hearing, and I believe that's because objectors filed an objection, which we later addressed in a conference call with the court. But you are correct, nothing happened on that date, and we did not renotice a hearing.
Wait, were you present in the courtroom? I mean, the minutes say attorney for petitioner Jesse Beyer. I'm not clear if that's just from the papers or because you were present.
I was not present.
So if you did not renotice a hearing on your petition, I mean, then how would the other parties have known that those issues would be taken under consideration by the district court and fully resolved?
Because we filed a petition and we expected that there would be at least some response to the issues that we addressed in our petition. The only response came in the form of the objector's objection that they filed. Again, we did not request that the district court, following our January hearing, we didn't request that the district court consider anything other than what was discussed during that hearing. But our agreement or the discussion that we had regarding the scope of that hearing in no way bound the district court's authority to make the decision that they did in considering the full scope of the petition.
Thank you.
Any other questions? All right. Thank you. We will go back to Mr. Reddall.
Thank you, Your Honor. I just want to address a couple things. Number one, the statute that Mr. Westrick referenced that supersedes Higgins is 524.2-709. It's referenced on page 7 of the transcript from the hearing. I don't believe it's contained in anything else.
Could you repeat that, please?
524.2-709. Specifically, it would be subdivision B. And it doesn't overrule Higgins. What it does is it defines representation that you define it as you divide it into as many equal shares as there are surviving children of the designated ancestor and deceased children who left surviving descendants. It's the analysis that we were talking about earlier as to what the definition of right of representation is. It's the statute that defines it under the Uniform Probate Code. So Higgins is not bad law. Higgins has not been overruled. There's simply a statute that incorporates the definition that Higgins already used. It's basically the common law definition.
I wanted to ask you earlier, but we did run out of time. I'm just looking at the respondents, the respondent cross appellate objector's brief on page 10. And the arguments made that basically in order to determine the donor intent, we've got to look at all the provisions of the trust, and they go through each of the articles which they claim supports their position that this was not where Ms. Drill, Brenda Drill, would have the right to devise her property. In other words, all she got was a life estate. How do you respond to that argument? And it's the second paragraph of page 10 where they go through all those articles.
So specifically, number one, the language that they're really getting at is that right of representation, that somehow indicates a life estate. And then they talk about this resetting the beneficiaries. In their initial memorandum in the lower court, they said it changed from pro rata to per capita when we pointed out that that's not what happens. If you look at the actual trust language, which is contained, it's copied, the relevant language is copied in our memorandum starting at page 9. We have a singular gift. It's Article 4, Section 2. Upon the death of the donor, the income from the trust and the assets of the trust shall be distributed as follows. And then it lists 10 people, two of whom unequivocally get life estates. The document contains a special provision that says for Alvin and Ruth Burkle, their shares get redistributed. That's not contained for anyone else. And then we have 2.2, which again is in the same section. It says, upon the death of the original donees, distribute the principal. So if you were to have a life estate, for example, Brenda took Carl's share at the donor's death. Brenda didn't take a life estate. Brenda's death didn't trigger a distribution of principal. It didn't prohibit a distribution of principal. It had absolutely nothing to do with it. The lives of the original donees simply determined the date at which the principal would come out. And delaying enjoyment of benefits is not the same as not owning those benefits. You can have a vested fee in something and not have the right to it yet. For example, a bond. If I have a bond that pays out the principal 10 years from now and I get interest, if I die 3 years from now, I don't. It doesn't go away. It's part of my estate. It goes there. You then look at Article 5. And Article 5 specifically notes, on the death of the donor, if none of the donees of the donor are then living. It does not reference surviving issue of the donees, anything. It simply says, if they're all dead, do this. There is no concept that there are people that took a vested remainder on the donor's death, which is what would happen with a life estate. You would have the life tenant and you would have the remainder holder. That doesn't exist under this document. The district court then goes on to argue that a spendthrift provision does this. And we note, while that issue is not litigated very extensively, it was litigated in Maryland about 72 years ago. And they specifically note that it is a descendable interest, even with a spendthrift provision. We are not saying that Mr. Gray has the right to go outside of the trust, but that he has the right to advance it. It's simply that Brenda's interest was divisible. And I think the last thing is specifically that the issue of whether or not someone was a beneficiary is distinct from the issue of the vesting date. And it does require some factual analysis. The legal issues as to when the vesting date was and what the language of the document means are the only things that we're asking this court to deal with.
All right, can I ask you this? As with regard to your client, I mean, the only issue is whether Brenda Drill had the right to devise her interests to your client, right? In other words, he's not claiming that he takes by virtue of his lineage.
That is correct. So once you correct the error regarding the life estate, then it's just a simple factual matter of connecting the dots to Mr. Gray through the interest that he would have taken.
So the issue is whether Brenda Drill had the right to devise her property to your client, or whether by virtue of the language of the trust that it had to be distributed on a pro rata basis among.
Well, the pro rata distribution would still, again, it's to the then current income recipients. So the only way that Brenda loses is if she took, for example, the life estate that the court really had as a fee tail, but it referred to it as a life estate. That's the only way she doesn't have something that she can descend down. Otherwise, she had the entire bundle of sticks. She just couldn't use all of them yet, but she had all of them. But we would need to establish exactly how Lorna's shares went to Brenda. Carl's is pretty obvious, but again, that factual issue would need to be proven up. And then again, we do have these other beneficiaries on that table that would come into play with the breach of fiduciary duty claims of the objectors.
Mr. Reddall, can I just clarify that last point? And if I might, Judge Hooten, I know our time is...
No, that's fine. You may proceed.
Thank you. I thought I heard Mr. Westrick indicating that those dots are not in issue. And so in other words, there'd be no factual issue if indeed our court agreed with your client's position in terms of what vested and that it was a fee interest. It's my understanding there's no factual dispute and that the instruction to the trustee would be that Paul Gray, what he's receiving is what he should continue to receive. Did I misunderstand? I thought I heard Mr. Westrick indicate that. Did you understand that differently?
In all candor, it's not in the record. And therefore, for us to come to this court and say you should make these assumptions because we didn't fight over it before because no one talked about it seemed a bit disingenuous. However, I don't believe there's a legitimate dispute that Brenda took Lorna's interests. It just is not part of the record for this court to say on page 5 that happened. And therefore, we specifically did want to make that known.
Okay, any further questions?
May I, Judge Hooten, just ask one more? So, Mr. Reddall, I guess it appears you may have briefed more than you wanted to brief because in your view, the district court's decision went beyond just the issue that you had noticed. But so could you, I mean, I'm just a little bit unclear about what you're asking us to do. Could you outline, please, sort of in your view, if you had, you know, could you point us to what an opinion would look like that is what you think we ought to do to correct the error? I mean, could you outline that opinion and what it would say on each of the issues that have been briefed?
Yes, Your Honor. So number one, it would leave the vesting date determination alone because it's not challenged. It would reverse the remainder of the order. It would specifically provide instructions regarding the definition language, mainly based on Higgins, which is controlling authority in Minnesota. It would inform the district court as to what that language means. And then to the extent that the court applies that analysis and says, based on that, Brenda Drill took Carl's share, the issue of whether Brenda took Lorna's share or any other issues would be sent to the district court for factual determination in light of the understanding of the language based on Higgins. With respect to the other issues that are at play in the appeal, all of those would need to be remanded for actual hearing. Nothing was presented on any of those outside issues, but in determination of the beneficiaries, we would ask this court to simply provide clarity, reversing the court's erroneous decision on the life estate issue, correctly implementing the Higgins decision and what the right of representation language means, and then leaving intact the vesting date question.
When you refer to other issues, do you mean other issues regarding Mr. Gray's claim, or are the other issues regarding the trustee's petition for approval?
The other issues regarding the trustee's petition. It was a fairly lengthy petition. There were a number of issues there, and all of those were not heard.
Okay, thank you.
All right, very good. Counsel, thank you for your excellent briefing and presentation today. We will take the matter under advisement and do a decision within the statutory period of time.